My name is Luke Hansen, and I'm an associate editor at America Magazine, and I'm in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Religious Education Congress. And today I'm speaking with Maureen Sullivan, who is a Dominican Sister of Hope of New York City. And she is a professor of theology at St. Anselm College, and she has written two books on Vatican II, 101 Questions and Answers on Vatican II, and The Road to Vatican II, Key Changes in Theology, both published by Paulus Press. Thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
So first, I'd like to ask you about Vatican II, because of course we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Council right now. So what, in your view, over the course of the last 50 years, is really the one of the key legacies of the Council for our church today?
I think, and perhaps this is due to my great appreciation for the man who initiated the Council, John the 23rd. But if you study the church in the decades before Vatican II, there was a great affection for the concept of immutability, that we could not change. And then along comes Vatican II and tells us change is a possibility. It was the herald of change, and not just change for change's sake, but for not to be afraid to allow new data, new questions, new input to help us to tell the story, the Christian story, to a new generation that will become meaningful for them. So one of the legacies is that we were no longer tied into that articulations of the faith could not change. We need to take serious the generation to whom we are addressing the message. And I think with John the 23rd's, famous open up the windows and let fresh air in, I think that is one of the things that comes out of the Council. I mean, of course, there were liturgical, there are sacramental, there are all sorts of other things that we could talk about. But the overall umbrella is those things could happen because change was not a bad word anymore. And maybe development would be a better word than change, because people sometimes think change has another connotation. But that the world is unfolding as according to God's plan, and we should expect development. And John seemed to make that a possibility for us.
Is that kind of openness to change something that you continue to see in the church today? Would you consider that a legacy that's really had its impact on the church, or would you consider that an unfinished business of the Council?
A part of me would love to be able to say that unfolding, or that great deep appreciation for the possibility of the Holy Spirit continuing to work in the church, which is how I understand development, I'd like to be able to say that I really see that, not just as a legacy, but as continuing in our time. But I think there's been, in recent decades, somewhat of a resistance to change, to development, and perhaps to excessive a use of the freedoms provided by Vatican II. And so I think there are those who have been wary of that kind of idea of development and have pulled back a bit. In terms of the unfinished business of Vatican II, I don't see that as an unfinished business. We just have not continued to exercise it in the same way. But if you are looking for me to answer something about the unfinished business of Vatican II, everything that I've read in these years leading up to the anniversary of Vatican II, and by theologians who I have great admiration for, Ladislaus Orsi, a canon lawyer, he's a Jesuit, Gerald O'Collins, these are people, Massimo Fagioli, these are people who are really, grounded in the legitimate theology of Vatican II. And I think if we were to ask all of these people what still has to be done, I think one, at least among their top three, would be, we have not implemented the collegial nature of the church. We are still more in a model of a pyramid model, which was prevailed before the Council. It has been called by some as the CEO model, where all power resides in a central party in Rome, and that message is simply relayed to those in outlying dioceses.
Could you flesh that out a little bit more, and what that vision of being church looks like, a more collegial vision of how the bishops relate to each other and with the people of God?
I could, because it is so much of a New Testament model. And that's what I'm trying to do with my students in my church course. If you look at the early church, you see that the early Christian communities that were founded by the various initial members of the followers of Jesus the Christ. So the Church of Ephesus has special needs, special concerns. It may not look exactly like the church in Corinth. It may not look like the church in Jerusalem. They were united in the faith, but they developed certain structures or ways of being church that met the needs of the people in that community. And I think as you study the history of the church, we lost sight of that beautiful diversity, you know, unity with diversity, because they were united in their bishops were united in the creed. That creed was shared with the people in the community. But when it came to the structures or the external realities of living out the church, they did not seem to be afraid to alter structures in the church that would enable Ephesus to live the life better, or Corinth. And so if you study the history of the church, more and more you hear theologians talking about this pyramid model of the church. And there are all sorts of sociological, political reasons that this developed. It's not just religious. But be that as it may, you have a model where all important decision making must be made at the center in the apostolic see of Rome. And that worked very well for a time. But we have become, you know, a globalized world and a globalized community. We have, as I'm often telling my students, I think the Church of Asia looks different from the Church of America. Mm-hmm. And I think the Church of Africa has needs that we just don't have. I might even say the Church of Brooklyn has different needs than the Church of Wyoming right here in the United States. And so the way I would flesh it out is I think that the local bishop, you know, united in faith with his brother bishops and his brother bishop in Rome, the Pope, we the communities, united in the creed that unites us, we might have certain diversities in the structures that are put into place so that we could live out the story in a way that is that meets the needs of our. So I see collegiality. Primal papacy is still a valid concept, and that is, of course, that the Pope's focus, the Pope serves as the center of unity for the entire Roman Catholic Church, the universal church. But that does not take away from the autonomy, or should not take away from the autonomy of the local bishop and the local church. And Vatican II made great strides, at least in its documents, on the value of the local church and the need for the local church to, you know, in one sense, is there such a thing as a universal church? It's not like you can go visit tomorrow. There are only concrete realizations of the universal church. So it's the Abbey Church at St. Anselm, where I teach. It's the Cathedral of St. Joseph in Manchester. It's Transfiguration Parish on Kelly Street. These are all concrete realizations of what we would call the universal church. So just like you are a concrete realization of maleness, you know, maleness doesn't go down the street by itself. It's embodied in Father Luke. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think I would love to see us take a look at the theology of local church, which provides that kind of diversity, and the impetus toward collegiality that was clearly on the minds of many of the bishops at Vatican II. I'd like us to take another look at that.
You mentioned a globalized world that we live in, and it's a world of rapid changes. Now, it's only been, in terms of church history, it hasn't been that long since the last council. It's been 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it raises the question about whether it's timely to call another council to address some of the concerns that you've been raising. So what would you see as advantages or drawbacks to calling another council at this time?
I have been back and forth so many times on should we or shouldn't we have a Vatican III. And I don't know if I can put these all in order, but one theologian said, well, let's have, you know, Manchester won or Brooklyn won, but don't have it at the Vatican because it would be under the same constraints that the preparatory period was during under John the 23rd. There's just too much of this, we own it in Rome. Maybe we need a fresh pair of eyes looking at it. So maybe the next big council or ecumenical council should be held, but it would be held somewhere else. All right. That's one of the things I have heard. As far as regardless of where you hold it, whether or not we need one or should have one, there was a time, and I have evolved on this, but there was a time that I said, no, of course we can't have Vatican III yet. We have not sufficiently implemented Vatican II, and we haven't. We still haven't. But then I recognized something else. There are certain issues that are crucial, I think, to our church today that probably would never be addressed at the local level. I don't think our bishops would either feel comfortable. I'm not so sure that they even have the local authority to do that. I really don't know what comes under the juridical powers of the bishop. But I'm thinking of the shortage of ordained ministers in the church today. And this is not a cry for female ordination or for anything along those lines. All I'm calling for is that we have to look and see that this is a real problem. As I said to you earlier, for years I taught in my church class something called priestless parishes. I did not mean in my own state at that time, but now we are at that point where little by little we're having insufficient ordained ministers to serve the sacramental life of the church, and that is of deep concern to me. So I'm thinking we need another major council of some sort perhaps to address that. I think we have to look at the role of women in the church. More and more that I'm reading, and again, we can leave the issue of female ordination out, but there are more and more people that are quite seriously calling for women to have a serious voice in the governing of the church, and I'm not sure what that would look like, and I haven't given it all that thought, but I believe that it should be looked at. I also think that the role of the layperson in the church. Vatican II was the very first council to issue a document dedicated solely to the layperson in the church, and that is to its credit. It's a magnificent document. But I'm wondering that the invitation that we issued to them almost 50 years ago, that by virtue of their baptism, they share in the fullness of what it means to be church, have we provided educational opportunities for them to get a degree? It costs a lot of money to go to graduate school, but if you or I, if sister or father decide we want to go to graduate school, probably our congregations could probably find a way. Mm-hmm. I know married men and women who would love to get a degree so that they can go on to do pastoral work in their parishes and whatever, because you don't want to have unqualified people serving the people of God, but they are going to be the next major network of evangelization. So I see them as something that should be put on the agenda if we were to have. Now, there's another theologian who said maybe we don't need another ecumenical council, but what we do need every 50 years is a general church council where we would come together and rethink, relook, where are we now? Don't let it go because things are changing so fast. See, in the years gone by, you know, Trent, maybe we wouldn't have a council for how many long? It would take that long for the information to get to the people. Mm-hmm. They didn't have Twitter, they didn't have Facebook, etc. But in our time, information is immediately sent out to the people of God. And so therefore, you know, I think it was Joseph Kamanchak who said that the church changed more in the 10 years after the Second Vatican Council than it did in the 100 years prior to the council. Mm. And that's because we are a society on the move. We just do things more quickly, and so change occurs more quickly. So I don't think we want to wait another 100 years for us to say, okay, let's look back and see how it goes. I think I'm leaning more towards, yes, either a general church council or bring us to Vatican III, and I would like to go on the record as wanting to be a representative for the female population at the council. All right, just let it, you can cut that if you want. But that's what I feel very strongly about. We should have women at that council for all, you know, for sure.
One of the things that you talked about at the LA Congress today was the connection between the Second Vatican Council and John the 23rd, which is your passion, with the new evangelization with John Paul II, and now the Year of Faith promulgated by Pope Benedict the 16th. What do you see as the connection between these sort of three markers in the last 20 years of church history, or in the last 50 years of church history?
Yeah, I think what surprised me, because when I was asked to do a talk, not here, this is sort of a re-rendition of a previous talk, but another group wanted me to speak about Vatican II, the new evangelization, and the Year of Faith. And so when I was doing the research for that, I thought, how am I going to pull these three things together? First of all, I think John the 23rd just represents a different model of Pope. So how do I bring him in to the discussion of John Paul II and Benedict the 16th, who seem to be more of the same mindset? But then when I started to do the research, I realized that, number one, The language used by all three popes was almost identical in the call that they made for whether it be Vatican II, New Evangelization, or the Year of Faith. Each of them said, we want to deepen the faith of the Catholic person. We do not want to be mediocre. We want them on fire with the faith. And so we want to deepen the faith that is already there. And then they each said, and we have to find, in order to do this, we have to find new methods. We will follow methods that are being used in contemporary discussions today about what works in conveying a message. And we want the message to be made more with more efficacy. So deepen the faith of the people and find a way to say it in such a way that it will be more efficacious. Because it didn't seem to be, we were becoming mediocre and I think complacent. So in those two matters of being a moment of renewing the faith and how you might do that with regard to the use of new methods, to me was incredible, because as I think I mentioned at the presentation, I think it's in the 1950s that Pius XII said there will be only one approach to theology to be used in all theology schools, and he was referring to Thomism, the theology of the schoolmen in the 13th century. No other approach was being welcomed, and yet you have three contemporary popes saying, no, I think what we have to do is we have to find what works, you know, in the field of communication, and use it. And we all know that we are a social media today. We are an instant messaging people today. And those three men seem to be saying, if it will further our ability to reach the people of God, it bears looking at to see if it's a legitimate use of evangelization.
You've described challenges facing the church today, the need for a new evangelization. One of the things that has been discussed in America's Pages as of late is the role of the theologian in this, and the theologian's relationship with the magisterium, with the College of Bishops. How would you, as a theologian teaching at St. Anselm College, how would you describe the role of the theologian and that relationship to the magisterium?
I would begin by just describing what I think the theologian is. And in his book, The Shape of Catholic Theology, the Dominican Father Ada Nichols says, there are three misconceptions out there about what a theologian does. One misconception is, well, you really can't do theology because you're dealing with mystery. So really what you're doing is you're doing spirituality. And Nichols goes on to say, no, that's not true. Of course, you would hope that a theology engenders a spiritual life. But he quotes St. Thomas about that we are all made with the dynamism for God. There must be a way for us to come to understand what we're searching for. And so, in fact, I would say, like Ada Nichols, theology is a science. It is self-critiquing. It uses a methodology. We are not free to say whatever we want. The second misconception, he says, that people have about theologians is that they are basically on hand to repeat what the magisterium has said on any given topic. There is some truth to that, because as a Roman Catholic theologian, to be orthodox, I must reflect what the official teachers of my church say, and I do. But that's not sufficient. Nichols says that the task of a theologian is much wider. And he goes on to talk, and sometimes I use the example in my class of an onion, that in the center of the onion is all the truths of Revelation, and that every generation of theologian has had to peel away the layers. And when you do that, you get more light can penetrate into the center. It's not quite so dense, the onion. And so every generation has been getting not new truths. Revelation does not change. But every new generation gets deeper insights. More light has been shown on it. The third thing that Nichols says is that theologians are basically professional rememberers. They know everything there is to know about their field, and they just kind of spout it out. And he says that's so not true. He said, one, granted, they have to know some things about their discipline. But he said what the theologian does with all that information is that he or she provides a cohesive understanding of how those facts fall together. So it's not just a matter of Googling this and Googling that. The theologian is going to systematically put them together as a whole in their messaging. That's one thing about what a theologian does. My second thing would be, I'm very Pauline in my understanding of the people of God and the church. And Paul was very, very strong on a theology of charisms, that each of us gets charisms that someone else doesn't get, and the only reason we get them is to build up the body of Christ. And I often use the example that my sister Eileen is a hospice nurse, and when she hears I'm coming to a conference like this, she says, I don't know how you get up and talk in front of all those people. And I say to her, I don't know how you go into houses of death every day and not only comfort the patient, but their families, which is devastating. And so what I tell my classes is that I think my sister Eileen is a healer. I'm not. I'm not good when other people are suffering, but I think I'm a teacher. So I'm doing what my sister can do. She's doing what I can't do, but we're both building up the body of Christ. I think it should be that relationship between theologians and the bishops. Theologians have a charism, and that charism is that they have been invited to investigate, to dig deeper, to ask questions, and to allow new data and new information to be brought to bear upon the fides quae, the faith of the people. The charism, I think, of our bishops is, among others, is to guard and protect the deposit of faith, the ancient deposit of faith. If we both work together, then we have a harmonious relationship, because I will be offering up insights to my magisterium saying, in my research, I found something, and because they will trust my charism, they will at least give it a hearing. There may be a time when the decision will be rendered that this is their interpretation of the message at the time. I have to trust that the spirit that has been vouchsafed to them to guard the faith. This does not mean that they are always right, because we know that there have been mistakes made in the past. Witness Pius IX, and you know, there is no such thing as freedom of religion. Vatican II would completely reverse that. But the point is, in an ideal world, a shared respect for charism, I think, would be my way of understanding the best way for theologians and bishops to serve the people of God.
When you stand in front of your students day in and day out, what kinds of questions are they asking? What concerns do they bring to the table in these questions about God and theology and church?
It's funny. I'm amazed that they are as curious as they are. Vatican II, I think they're quite excited about when I teach that course, because they've never known any other church before the one that came out of Vatican II. In other words, the understanding of church that came out of Vatican II, and all of the changes, the liturgy, the sisters shedding religious garb, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the only church they've ever known, so they are fascinated by when I describe what it was like to be a religious before Vatican II, or the priest celebrating the Eucharist with this back to us, and the impersonal nature of it. And so their questions in that course generally are, oh, I think it's a good thing that I wasn't in the church at that time. I don't think I would have enjoyed the faith. So I think they're gaining an appreciation. And as I try to explain to them, that model of church met a need at the time. And you know, it produced great people. It could produce me. So I'm happy as a clam. And so it produced John the 23rd. So I never want them to think that, you know, the pre-Vatican II church somehow was such a mistake. No, it served its time. And its people, and it produced many saints and scholars and some wonderful people. But just like the human body has to change in order to grow and develop, the church is an organism, and it must grow and develop. And so I want them to see the kinds of changes that came about or developments that came about, and to let them know that not everything that came out of Vatican II was all that effective for the liturgical or the spiritual life of the people. In my church course, the questions are different. It is very hard to make a case for membership in the institutional church today to undergraduate students. They simply cannot comprehend that. What I think does help them is we begin with a book that looks at the New Testament as sources of ecclesiological understanding. And it's by this Miguel Gwembe. And it's marvelous, because all of part one said, these are the understandings of church that we might glean just from reading the scriptures. From the New Testament, because that's when it first began. So they start of warm. They kind of warm up to, now if we could return to that kind of a model of church, where it was more pure and less filled with pomp and circumstance. And I mean, there's a time for mystery and pomp and all of that. But I think they're a very basic group of people. They're not as drawn into that. I will tell you that one of the saddest questions I get and I get it practically every semester, because what I've done in my course is to present what the church could be, because the theology is there. Mm-hmm. And we do go over the high moments and the low moments, but basically what they're leaving me with is, this could be your church. Mm-hmm. And I might not say it to them that way, but I'm presenting the ideal. And every semester, at least one student says to me, I have two questions. What planet is your parish on so that I can come on Sunday, all right? Mm. And why have you remained a member of this church? Mm. Those questions sadden me. Mm-hmm. And because we've covered the glorious moments in the course, they know my affection. I tell them I love my church. I'm a vowed member of my church, and I want them to have an affection for this divinely found and divinely guided but human institution. But it is becoming more difficult to provide that affection for this institution, because they're only in the headlines seeing some of the negative things. So those would be the kinds of questions that I do get from them, and I try very hard. This is not a matter of catechetics that we're doing at a college, but I'm trying really hard to present an academic discipline that has them think critically, and that they can honestly see there. It's not absurd to be a member of this church, because this church is a beautiful thing. It was given to us by God. We simply have to work harder at achieving what can be achieved through the presence of the Spirit among us.
That brings me to the final question, which is about signs of hope. And, you know, what you can point to when you talk with your students about where the signs of the church, where the signs of hope in the church are today. What do you have to say to that?
I tell them more often than not, that the initial sign of hope for me, one that I can look up at, learn about, is Pope John XXIII, because he did an incredibly courageous thing at a time when it was same old, and up against the odds. He said he was inspired by the Holy Spirit to call this council, and for the 2.5 years or so of preparatory work, he suffered a great deal. Because there were many, he even referred to them as the prophets of doom in his opening speech, but there were many around him who really just basically tried to dissuade him from having the council. And yet, his council, in my estimation, produced so much good. It produced for me personally a model of religious life that is so healthy, that is so meaningful, that is so real, and that I don't have to repress any part of me to be a female religious in the United States today. It's just, it's given me a sense of freedom and the love of the Dominican way, etc. So this was a wonderful thing for me. So he becomes a sign of hope. I think coming to a Congress like this, I asked someone today how many people usually attend the conference, and the man who was welcoming us downstairs said, well, for the youth part of the celebration, we had about 15,000. And I thought, oh my gosh. And he said, you should come to that one day because it's so incredible. They're so excited. They're just, that gave me hope that 15,000 people would come to a youth celebration day at the Congress. And then I said, well, what about the other, three days? Like, what kind of a population do you get? How many? Comes to usually around 20,000. And I'm thinking, this many people who are coming, not because they have to, but because they're hungry to hear more. I think our church is in a good place if a Congress can, bring about that kind of interest in the people of God and want to learn more, and they're so enthusiastic when they're here. So the people of God, who come and participate in this and go back home and tell the story, they are a sign of hope for me. And I think the other, probably for me, the sign of hope is that I know that this church is not the Girls Club of America, begun by a human and so therefore could be taken down by a human. This church was divinely founded and divinely guided. It is in the hands of humans, and so we are a human organization which will be imperfect. But this really is our church, and it is God's church. And so there's a great, great, principle in theology called the principle of indefectibility. And it says that the promise of the risen Christ to be faithful to his church, I will be with you always, even till the end of time, is more powerful than any evil or sin that we can do. We will not destroy what God has begun. And so it gives me great hope to keep trying to build it up.
Sister Maureen Sullivan, a keynote speaker here at the LA Congress this year. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity. Take care.